The Bob Murphy Show, episode 59.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. My guest is Marcia Enright, and I originally wanted her to be on the show because I read an article she had written saying how she ran a private school and was against government vouchers. And that's something I agree with. And so I wanted to bring her to talk about that. But along the way, as you'll hear, we discuss the Montessori approach to education because among her other accolades, Marcia founded a Montessori school for her daughter when it was the appropriate time for that. And she also is the president of what's called the Great Connections seminar series, and she'll talk about that at the end of the interview. Her formal background, she went to earn a BA in biology at Northwestern University and an MA in psychology from the New School for Social Research. And I'll hold off on reading more from her bio because she's going to talk about that when we start the interview. And so without further ado, here is my interview with Marcia Enright. Well, Marcia, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I mentioned your official bio here in the introduction that the listeners just heard, but also just to set the stage, since we're going to be talking so much about education, can you just explain for the listeners, you know, what you do and why your perspective on these matters should be given more weight than, you know, just some random person plucked from the street?
Sure, sure. Well, I know that you became interested because of an article I wrote for a fee about against vouchers, and that's out of my experience as, well, not only my ideological positions, but also my experience with a Montessori elementary school, which I founded in 1990 and ran for about 27 years here in Chicago. And it goes from 3 years old to eighth grade. We try as much as possible to implement the authentic Montessori method because there's a lot of pressure on Montessori schools to conform to traditional methods as parents get worried about things. But so I know from that the kind of pressures that could arise. And my more recent project is bringing Montessori philosophy up to the young adult level and implementing it in a program that really reinforces their autonomy, their knowledge, their ability to think independently, and their skills. And that's called The Great Connections. So also I've written an article for a book, a chapter for a book called Common Ground on Common Core, about what education would look like in a free society. And so those are a few of the things I've written for Real Clear Markets. I've written for Objectivity. I've written for Montessori Life, Montessori Leadership. So I have a lot of background in this area.
Well, sure. Great. And maybe we spend just a bit talking about your experience founding the school and your experiences there. I guess for the listeners, I think probably most people have a vague idea of what Montessori is. Kind of like people generally know who the Amish are. But if you said, okay, well, what exactly do they believe? They would have no idea. So can you maybe just explain, you know, what, and also too, I'm curious, like, is it, how much of it is directly from, is it Maria Montessori?
Right.
That's where the name comes from. But like, how much is it directly from her? Or is it more, you know, sort of like Freudian psychology? Is it literally everything that Sigmund Freud believed? Or is there like a school of thought that kind of, you know, has been refined? Anything like that? Because I'm sure a lot of people, they vaguely know what Montessori is, but they really don't know specifically.
Sure. Well, Montessori is a radically different philosophy and methodology of education. It's got a very detailed implementation that has been being used for 100 years. Montessori was the first woman doctor in Italy, and after she started working, she worked for what was called the Orthophrenic School, which was for retarded children and autistic children. And she was given the task to help them learn. And she realized that they were so deprived of any kind of sensory experience in the institution that, they were in, that they would spend a lot of time playing with their food. So she realized they really needed a lot of, sensory stimulation. And she went about discovering what people for the last 200 years before her had discovered about education, and then creating materials to help the children learn.
Can I ask you, do you know, meaning just because of the fact that they were, you know, what we would nowadays say they were on the autism spectrum, or that because they needed more sensory stimulus, or do you mean back then the conventional wisdom was, oh, you put them in like in a room with, you know, nothing where they can hurt themselves, and so they were being, in other words, do they have even less stimulation than kids? Okay, I got you.
The latter, yeah. That was, she realized that. And anyway, they did, she learned, they learned so much from her program that they passed the state exam for normal children. Mm-hmm. And everyone was so amazed at this. You know, they were, she became instantly famous because of it. But her thought was, well, if these poor children could pass the state exam, what are normal children learning? Mm-hmm. And so then some years later, she ended up starting a school. I guess I don't want to spend too much time telling you the whole story, but it's quite interesting, actually. And it's a very different methodology. It's very individualized. It's developmentally oriented. She was the first to realize that children learn differently at different stages, and that they need different kinds of environment, so that very young children need a lot of sensory motor work. As they get older, they start becoming a little more conceptual, and then they become more and more abstract in their thinking as they get older and older. But still, one of her principles is that you want to have concrete understanding of every abstract idea that you're learning. Mm-hmm. And materials do this. So the classrooms are organized in a, with materials that are kind of like, it's kind of like games, but they call them work in the Montessori classroom. And the children work individually. The teachers spend a lot of time observing individual children and figuring out what they need to, what would be best for them to be introduced to next. They get lessons in small groups. They're able to decide whether they want to work on their math or their English, or take a snack first, or what order they're going to do things and how long they're going to work on it. There's a lot of thought put into the physical environment, how to arrange the physical environment so the child can be as autonomous as possible and yet be very civil with other children and with the teacher. There's a lot of part of the curriculum that's called grace and courtesy, which is how do you interact with other people well. All of the subject matter, whether it's history or whether it's mathematics or whether it's English or whether it's biology, there are materials that the children use to learn them. And they're on low shelves. She was the one to invent child-size furniture and to put all the materials on low shelves. And the children end up having tremendous growth in these classrooms because they're given the learning materials in the right way, the way that's developmentally appropriate, and they're able to follow their own interests. And you know that when you are interested in something, you're going to learn it a whole lot faster than if somebody tells you you have to learn something. Mm-hmm. So this is a lot of what's going on in a Montessori classroom. Now, of course, some children will be obsessed, for example, with mathematics and not be interested in learning how to read. And you do want them to learn how to read because you know that's important for adult life. So, and many other subjects like that. So as much as when this kind of thing arises, it's the teacher's job to make the subject matter so interesting and enticing that the child is basically seduced into becoming interested in doing that part of the curriculum.
Well, yeah, so that you actually just touched on a good point there. I was going to ask for clarification. I was wondering how much is it that, two students who are going through the same program, is it just they're getting the choice over the order in which they rotate between the predetermined subjects? Or is it really that, no, by the time, when they each of these children has spent whatever, 5 years in a particular program, is one of them going to have gone down much deeper into geometry than the other, and the other one might have gone deeper into literature, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Some of it's, it might, yes, exactly. The latter, that depending on their interests. So, and now on the other hand, you know, people don't always know what their interests are. So this is why you want to make all of the subjects be as interesting as possible to the children. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you have a child who's obsessed with dinosaurs, but he doesn't want to do any math, you can get him interested, as an example, by saying, well, how big is an Apatosaurus versus a Tyrannosaurus Rex? And you might go out in, outside into the parking lot and with chalk, and you'll actually measure out how, you look up in the encyclopedia, or of course nowadays on the internet, how big an Apatosaurus is, and then you look up how big a Tyrannosaurus Rex is, and then you'd measure that out in the parking lot, and the child could have much more of a sensory experience of, well, wow, how big were these things and how were they in relationship to each other, mm-hmm. you know? So, and then in that way would become more interested in the math, in math, because he'd see, well, this has to do with my interest.
Right. Rather than like some contrived thing where they're making change when if they don't buy something, they don't even care about money at that point, perhaps, depending on how old. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. And so I guess one, isn't there, is it also critical to the Montessori method of having kids of different ages all in the same classroom?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. The classrooms are arranged in developmental levels. So for example, 3 to 6 year olds are together. 6 to 9 year olds are together, 9 to 12 year olds, 12 to 15 year olds. The reason being that you can have materials that are approximately good for that developmental level, but a wide range of it. So some child might be way ahead in math, but behind in reading, and vice versa. And you have 3 years of material in that classroom. Also, socially, it's much more realistic to be in a class with people of different ages, because when you're working, how many times when you're working, are you working with people all of the same age? Almost never.
We're right. So, the only time I've ever been in a situation like that was when I went to school, you know, like exactly. This very artificial environment. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it gives you a much more realistic experience socially. And then you have another aspect to it that's positive, which is that the older children often end up being teachers to the younger children. And that has two benefits to it. One is children sometimes can explain things to other children better than adults can. And so the younger children can benefit from that. And also the older children are reinforcing their own knowledge, because you know mm-hmm. that being able to express what you know is kind of the last step of really knowing it. So
right. Like even at the college level, I know there were certain areas where I, you know, may have made remarks like when I was the first time, Bob's going to teach macro, you know, intro to macro this semester. And I thought, oh, I'm really going to learn macro now because I have to teach it, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Exactly. So those are some of the things about it. I mean, it's a very complex, very thought out into immense detail, the psychological, the social, the physical, and the intellectual environment is really thought out in a Montessori classroom. And the teachers are taught to be very self-reflective about what they're doing. So they're constantly thinking to themselves, you know, well, how should I implement this? And what's best for this child? And oh, what have I observed about that child? And how do I deal with this problem? So it's quite a complex job, Montessori teacher.
And I remember, because when my son was young, his mother and I had took him around to some, you know, like different things, like some places were straight up, like they were actual Montessori, and other places were more, they weren't Montessori, but they were, you know, self-directed learning, and the teachers called themselves guides and that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. yeah, in some of these environments, like compared to a quote regular school, one could not believe how mature, like these kids seemed like they were, you know, not human. I mean, you get what I'm saying? Like if someone's never seen it, I could see how parents who have never seen this kind of environment wouldn't believe kids could possibly be this interested and not need the teacher hanging over their shoulder and forcing them to do something, like just how they naturally get up and they sit there and they'll work for 3 hours on their worksheets and then go on to the next thing. And it's really amazing to behold. And and so I guess I'm curious your thoughts. I've heard some people say something along the lines of, oh yeah, Montessori works for a certain type of kid But for most kids, you know, the standard way, that's, you know, that kind of attitude. How do you feel about that?
Well, from what I've observed over the years is I have observed exactly the opposite, that Montessori works for most kids and is the rare child that does not benefit from being in a Montessori classroom.
And yeah, I mean, my thinking is that it's, you know, kids are naturally curious and they, especially the younger they are, they naively think adults know everything. Like, you got to get older before you realize, no, these adults are saying something with confidence. They don't know what they're talking about. And it's like, it's almost like regular schools kind of beat it out of you, like your desire to learn. Like they actually take learning about the world and somehow turn it into a drudgery, which is almost like an amazing feat that these, you know, quote, normal schools pull off.
You've absolutely got it. I mean, think about it. Two-year-old children, anybody who knows two-year-old children knows it is almost impossible. You have to beat a two-year-old to stop them from trying to learn. Mm-hmm. They're constantly investigating things. What happens by the time they're 8 years old in public school, in traditional school, where they don't even want to go to school? Mm-hmm. I mean, here's something that happened at our school. Over the course of many years, I have gotten multiple letters from parents that said to me, my child loves school so much that when he's sick, he lies to me so he won't miss school.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, like I said, my son was in it wasn't officially Montessori, but again, it was a very self-directed, and they called the kids like heroes or something, and the teachers weren't teachers, they were good. And I do remember when it was near the summer, he was happy to be going on vacation and like go to water parks and stuff, but he was really sad because he wasn't going to be able to go to school. And, mm-hmm. I was just like, wow, that's not quote normal.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it should be normal. Mm-hmm. It should be normal. I mean, I don't know how many people know the saying that Aristotle said, which was human beings desire to know. And, you know, you wonder sometimes because you see a lot of people who don't seem to spend much time wanting to know in school. But if you get a child, if you get humans in the right situation, they're voracious learners. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen a lot of people who once they get out of school, they find some interest and they just delve into it and know everything about that interest. If their desire to learn didn't get totally beat out of them, they'll be like that.
And so I'm curious then for you, your program, how does that work? Like, do you have to go somewhere and get officially certified in being a Montessori educator?
For the younger children, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so like, did you yourself go through a program like that? Or you just as an adult realized this is what I want, this is how I want to do it?
You know, when I was a kid, I really loved school, but I saw so many other kids were annoying me all the time because they were always goofing around and interrupting the learning, mm-hmm. until I realized that they were doing that because they were miserable. And so, and also I didn't like the social environment in school at all. And so I said to myself, okay, when I have kids, I'm going to find a different way of schooling for them so they don't have to go through that and so that they can really enjoy school. And when I read some articles about the Montessori method, I said, this sounds really good. And then I went out and just read everything I could find out. And I started observing at Montessori schools. And then my oldest child went to a well-established Montessori preschool, or what we call children's house, mm-hmm. here for 3 to 6 year olds. And then I wanted it for my children up as far up as they could get. So that's why I started the school, because we didn't have a good Montessori elementary school in the area.
Oh, okay. So you established it in time so that when it was appropriate or ready for your kids to go, that's what they just went into.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Right. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Now you mentioned earlier, so I'm paraphrasing here. I got the sense you're saying that, the parents might, you know, be amazed and wow, our kids love going to school. You know, we talk to our friends and their kids, it's a battle getting them to go to school every day and then drag them. And with us, it's not, but you know, we're just worried about, you know, what happens, how are they going to do on the SATs? You know, are they going to get into a good college if they've gone through this strange career? Is that the kind of thing where you're saying the parents put pressure on the.
Yes. Right. They start getting really worried as the child gets older. They usually love it when the child's in the 3 to 6 class, mm-hmm. because, you know, the children are so far ahead of other children and they tend to be very well behaved. And even children in infant toddler Montessori programs are different than other children because they're treated a certain way. They're guided on their behavior. They're given activities that really stimulate them. And so the parents tend to like it at the younger ages. But as the child gets older and older in elementary school, they start getting worried that they're not doing things the way everybody else is doing them. And they're worried that, because we don't use tests, the proof that the child has learned something is we have them show us how they've mastered the material. They give a demonstration about how they've used the material. So, for example, we have beads that we use to do arithmetical problems from the time they're 3 years old. So single beads are like 1 to 9, and then they're put into a bar that's a 10 bar, so that's 10, 20, 30, and then those are hooked together, and they make 100 square, and then 10 of those are put together, and it's make 1,000 cube. And the children can do arithmetical problems into the millions without writing anything down when they're 3 or 4 using this material. And it's actually the Montessori mathematical materials, there's hundreds of them, are amazingly brilliant. My son is an aerospace engineer, and he just had a wonderful time when he went to Montessori school, the way that he learned math there. And in fact,
I was going to say the way you were describing, the way I was picturing it, it sounds like it's not just teaching, you know, the place value, but also like geometry, like, you know, points and lines and area and volume and stuff. Yeah.
Right. You have the concrete instantiation of what it means to be squared and cubed, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and you were saying that's a good example of, you know, clearly some young kid that can do that knows very, you know, that's pretty advanced mathematics, you know, compared to a standard curriculum. But yet it's not that I say, oh, how did he do, you know, what was his grade in math this quarter or this semester or however, you know, it's not like there's this typical report card the way kids in a more traditional school would get. And so the parents start getting nervous, like, yeah, you know, how is it that they're worried the kid isn't learning it, or is it just they're worried they know there's these standardized tests coming up and they're wondering how are they going to do on them?
They don't know how to compare what they're learning at a Montessori school with what's going on in the traditional school. And yeah, and they worry about the tests. I mean, at our school, we give, and most Montessori schools, we give them standardized tests once a year, both as a practice and as a, so that the parents can see where they're at in standardized testing. And this is without a lot of prep either. You know, most schools, they do a tremendous amount of prep before they give them those standardized tests. But we, you know, maybe show them a little bit about, well, what the problems are like and how do you fill them out and how you're supposed to be quiet and how you do sit in the room and all that kind of thing, but not with a lot of preparation.
Right. You're not teaching to the test the way in some schools.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Now, the interesting thing, the kids that are really smart tend to just soar with this. And I'll give you an example. So we had a child who graduated from our first 8th grade class of 5 people. And he was always somebody who would get 99s on standardized tests, and he was quite smart. And he went on to the premier public high school here named Whitney Young, 5,000 people, okay, from a class of 5 to 5,000, to a school of 5,000. And he ended up becoming president of the class, and in the senior year, leading a big protest against testing that was in Time, reported about in Time magazine.
Well, that's great.
And then on the other side of it is we have many children who really struggle academically. In fact, over the years, I've seen many, many, many artistically oriented children have a real hard time academically. But in our school, it's what happens is since they're working at their own pace and we give them whatever help they want and they're not being compared to other people and they're not being told, oh, you have a disability or anything like that. They're encouraged to have a very good work ethic. They don't lose their self-confidence and they develop a very strong work ethic. And what we've seen with these children is when they go on to high school, they do fine in high school and then they end up thriving in some area that they're really good at. For example, we had two brothers who I was always worried about whether they were learning anything when I'd see them in the classrooms. And they went on and did fine in high school, and one became a designer for Google, and the other one became an illustrator for a California movie company. So they were artistic, and that's what they didn't lose their self-confidence. You know, that's one of the main things that happens with children that have any kind of trouble and they don't fit into the normal spectrum of what you're supposed to be doing. And we've had other children, too, who were extremely talented musically and struggled all the time with reading and arithmetic, but they went on to become the number one bassist in the state of Illinois and in three bands and just thriving mm-hmm. in what they loved to do.
And so part of what goes on there, you're saying like in a more traditional setting, those students who might have struggled in certain areas early on, they might just have gotten a label, you know, bad grade and filed away like, oh yeah, I'm bad at school or I'm stupid or I can't do math. And then they would have carried that for the rest of their lives.
Right. And, but they're not, yes, exactly. And that's what happens. And, but in a Montessori school, they don't come out with that. They do math as best as they can, you know, and they learn enough and they take their time. One thing that's interesting is that we found that, girls tend to need to children use the materials when they're learning a subject matter, as long as they need to. So, because the materials are like a concrete example, a concrete way of understanding whatever idea it is, whether it's a math idea, whether it's a English grammar. We have grammar symbols. We have a whole system for teaching grammar that's just brilliant. And so the children will use those as long as they need to. But then when they get to the point where they feel comfortable with dealing with the abstractions, they don't use them anymore. So what we found is in Montessori in general is that boys tend to not need to use the math materials after a while, but girls tend to need to use them longer. But when they do, they can do math just as complicated as boys.
Okay, that's very interesting. So I guess I'm curious, what would be, like, in terms of people who are pushing back against it? Because it's, obviously you are a fan of this approach, and that's why you chose it for your children and then even set up a school for it. I'm curious, I imagine two of the standard objections would be, oh, they're not being socialized properly and or enough. And then the other one is, does this require a pretty low student to teacher ratio, or is that not the case?
In a well-functioning Montessori classroom, you can have 30 children with one teacher and one assistant.
Oh, okay. So that's not different from certain other traditional settings.
Mm-hmm. And what was the first question again? Oh, that they're not being gosh, that's hilarious. Anybody who thinks they're not being socialized, they're being socialized better than you are in a traditional school.
Right. I mean, my joke is I was a very gregarious child, you know, when I was little, like 6 or 7. And then I'm still recovering from like being painfully shy. And, you know, why? Oh, because 6th through 9th or 10th grade was really bad for me, you know, in the grand scheme. I've heard other people tell a story. What happened to me wasn't a big deal really. But at the time it was like, it totally made me withdraw. And I was just looking around and, you know, defending myself from anyone who's going to insult me or pick on me, you know, and it's, mm-hmm. it's like, no, I think that messed me up. It would have been good if I just hung out with adults and a broad age spectrum of kids rather than, you know, going in with a bunch of kids who were going into puberty and putting them all in one room for 8 hours or one, you know, building for 8 hours. That almost seems like designed to mess kids up socially.
Right. And you get this terrible pecking order going on, you know, and since they're not really engaged in the work that they're doing. So in a Montessori classroom, the children, when they're doing their work, they don't have to collaborate with somebody. They can just do their work by themselves, but they can if they want to. And what you see happening is that they invite other children to work with them. And you get them working in these teams. They just naturally develop teams working together on, say, a big math material or a big geography material or something like that. And it just is such a friendly atmosphere. And instead of it being a competitive and combative atmosphere where you have to have some kind of pecking order, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's interesting. You know how in most schools where it's in the different grades, the 8th graders are scary people?
Right, you know, right.
In the Montessori school, the 8th graders like the heroes,
mm-hmm.
and the younger children just love to see them and have them come down to their classroom and engage with them, because they're not afraid. They're not going to get treated badly, you know.
Right, right. I suppose we don't have to dwell too long on this, especially unless you want to. But I imagine a lot of my listeners, what they're thinking is, oh, I understand this critique of the traditional schooling approach, but what we do, it's not that we send my kid to a Montessori, what we do is homeschool. So do you, mm-hmm. do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, homeschooling can be wonderful too. You know, I think it's a great way. And the homeschool children are very well socialized usually. Not always, but ones that I've met, they have that kind of self-confidence with people of all different ages, including adults. And of course, they're allowed, depending on the homeschool, but they're allowed to follow their own interests. They're encouraged to speed ahead as far as they want. You know, a lot of time is wasted in school, mm-hmm. getting in lines and waiting for other people and doing some bureaucratic thing. You could learn so much faster in these other environments and in homeschool, for example.
Right. I remember when I was younger that, you know, if I could just take the textbook and go by myself and read, I could go through it so much more quickly. And I think, you know, in fairness, I was presumably a better student than a lot of my peers were. But even just in general, the idea that everybody is going to be moving at the same pace through the material as 29 other people sit in the room, that's unrealistic. Like you were saying, some people are going to move through certain subjects faster than others. And yeah, the Montessori approach, or I guess homeschooling could just, you know, be considered that a version of that, where it's just, you know, you're inside the household and doing that kind of approach. Mm-hmm. You know, you proceed at your own pace, and the things that you fly through, yeah, go ahead and fly through. Don't wait for everyone else to keep asking the teacher for clarification. The teacher can't leave everybody behind. And so, you know, go through this very slow pace for the stuff that you're good at.
Well, and I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I would spend hours with the encyclopedia because I would be going from one subject to the other. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd look up some article I was interested in, and then it would mention some other article, and I'd go over there and back, you know, all over the place. Nowadays, of course, you have that experience on something like Wikipedia where you can click through to the related subject. And you can just learn a tremendous amount. And of course, what's great is you're interested in that subject. You looked it up. And so you're going to remember that a lot easier than if somebody told you to go look it up.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I've noticed even with me, like with my consulting work or whatever, it's much easier for me to go read about something if someone's not paying me to do it. It's perverse. Like if someone hires me to do something, all of a sudden it's not as interesting because now it's work.
Yeah, exactly.
And my work is interesting to me. That's why I went into it, but it's still.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe you don't feel like looking that up right now.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, it's funny.
Especially if I'm like eating my lunch or something and I'm going to be looking at internet tabs and browser, you know, I'm not going to be looking up something that's for a project I'm getting paid for. It's going to be something else that like maybe slightly related to it, but not the literal thing.
Right. Well, you've probably, if you have any control over your job, which it sounds like you do, I'm sure you found that you kind of learn after a while to follow your interest. And so, for example, I have a lot of accounting I have to do for various things I'm doing. And I always do it late at night because I can't think about anything more interesting than that.
Right, right.
You know, to me, right. It is interesting. You know, since I'm not naturally interested in that kind of in accounting, I'm so thankful that there are people that find it really interesting. I'm really happy about that division of labor, you know.
Exactly.
But yeah, so if I try to follow my what I feel like doing at any particular time, because I find that I'm just much more productive when I do.
And also too, like, cause yeah, I do consulting work. And so if I'm at any given time, if I have three or four projects that I'm working on, it's good, because if one of them, for whatever reason, I don't feel like doing right then, I don't just waste the day. I can go work on the other stuff, which, you know, sounds like exactly. The Montessori approach. Yeah.
Well, and you know, that the human mind takes time to integrate material that it's learned or that it's working on, especially when you're working on any kind of problem, you have to come up with a creative solution. It takes time to do that integration. And you know, the typical way that it works is that you take in a lot of data, you think about the problem, and then you go away from it. And that's when your mind, it does a kind of some kind, and your subconscious is doing a kind of like mental crunching of all the material and putting it in its orders. And then you can wake up the next morning and have the solution. But oftentimes you need that time away from thinking about the problem in order to actually come up with the solution.
Yeah, I've written many blog posts while I was grocery shopping.
Exactly.
You know, meaning that, yeah, it's just kind of percolating and bouncing around. And it's not that I'm literally seeing an essay in my head, but I'm kind of just organizing the structure of it. And oh, I'll make, you know, these 4 points, and then I just sit down and bang it out. But if I hadn't gone shopping while I was thinking about it, I would have sat there with the, you know, it would have been harder to type it up.
It's so funny. There's this phenomena of when you're working on a creative problem that you, of having a period when you're conscious, like your conscious attention is engaged in something else, a low level activity like driving or walking or grocery shopping or something like that. And your subconscious is kind of in the background working on it. And that there's tremendous amounts of research about how often that happens when people are working on things, you know. So I wanted to say that the current research in human development and in learning has validated one aspect of Montessori education after another. And there's just a tremendous amount of research that validates what happens in a Montessori classroom. There's a book called Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, mm-hmm. that was written by a psychologist from the University of Virginia about this. And she married into a Montessori family and thought they acted very cultish about it because they were constantly talking about how great it was. So she set about to kind of look into, well, do they know what the heck they're talking about? And then she became a big advocate because it fits in with all of the research. And I mean, I think it's because Montessori herself was a genius scientist who could recognize from direct observation what is validated by, you know, double-blind experiments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I mean, that doesn't surprise me. That's very interesting. Hey, folks, let's take a break from my discussion with Marcia Enright. As we're talking about alternative curricula, what better thing to bring up than Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom? I have 2 courses on the history of economic thought, and Tom's rounded up other scholars who present ideas on history and politics and economics. It's things that they didn't want you to learn if you went to a standard type of school. For more details, go to bobmurphyshow.com/classroom. Well, now that we've sort of established your credentials here, let me, the reason that I, you know, the direct reason I wanted you to come on here is because your view of school vouchers fits mine. And so I like to have a confirmation bias and bring people on who agree with me on this.
Right.
Because,
right.
So they, just to set the stage, there's a lot like, Milton Friedman is of course big on this. And I think in your article, you show that even Hayek was, you know, an advocate of this, and there's a strand in the free market community, libertarian or, you know, conservative community, where they think that the obvious solution, you know, everybody recognizes that government schools are, you know, are not a good idea, and private schools do better than them typically. And so their solution is, oh, let's end, you know, the government. They might use the word monopoly. That's not really the right word, but by having school vouchers. And so we'll let the parents go, and we'll introduce some competition, and you'll see these government schools get up, you know, shape up. And they also will have slogans along the lines. This might not be an exact one, but I've seen stuff along the lines of, you know, why should just, you know, the students of rich families get to get good educations? We think everybody should. And what's weird to me is you wouldn't use that logic anywhere else. You wouldn't say, why should, you know, there should be vouchers for automobiles, because why should just rich people get to drive Ferraris, you know? So it's,
yeah,
it's kind of interesting that the rhetoric that some libertarian types often use in this, and there's, you know, the counteries, they push back on me and say, well, it's because I'm already getting taxed for it. And I understand all that, but your concern was a much more specific one, and you certainly have credibility on this issue, and you would know. And so why don't you explain, you know, how could somebody, you obviously are familiar with the ideas of liberty, and, you know, if Milton Friedman was for school vouchers, what, you know, don't you understand the virtues of competition?
Well, and I know, and I certainly have tremendous sympathy for the children that are stuck in terrible public schools because their parents can't afford to go anyplace else, and they don't have the political power to get the authorities to make the school any better. I mean, it's just appalling what is going on today. I was reading the Illinois Policy Institute came out with some information today about how since 2010, the amount of money in our Illinois system going to retiree pensions has increased 100%. So it went from 20% of the school budget to 40% of the school budget.
Wow.
Which means that now all that money that might be going to actually educate the kids is going to the retiree pensions. So I have tremendous sympathy for these parents, you know, but I don't think, and I understand the argument that you want to get those, you want to give these children an opportunity to get out of there. We want competition. We want free markets. You know, the United States has one of the most amazing education markets in the world because of capitalism. We had more universities in Ohio than in the whole of Europe in 1830. And we have 5,000 universities and colleges because people of every stripe and every ideology and religion decided, well, I want to open an institution of higher learning. And they did. But we'll come back to this about how what would happen with vouchers is exactly what's happening with the colleges right now. But anyway, so I'm greatly sympathetic to that. But I don't think they've thought through the consequences of vouchers themselves. Because vouchers are forms of money that are given out by the state authorities to be used at whatever, at a school that you want.
Mm-hmm.
So the money is still directly in control of the state authorities. It decides what schools it can be used at and what schools it can't be used at. And it looks great at first. But my worry is that if you had a large program in vouchers, then only the richest schools would be able to say, oh, we're not going to use vouchers. Okay, so everybody else, all the schools for, you know, middle class and working class children that are private would basically have to take vouchers or probably go out of business because the parents wouldn't want to be ponying up the money separately, you know.
Right.
Because when you think about it, when a child goes to a private school, that parent is paying tuition twice. Because he's paid in his property taxes for the public schools, and now he's paying for the private school. So, you know, very few parents, middle class and working class parents, if they had the opportunity to get a voucher, would say, well, I'm still going to pay tuition, right? So, and the problem is that once the vouchers are used, there's inevitably going to be corruption. So then the state authorities are going to come in and they're going to say, well, we have to do something about this corruption. We have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that the vouchers are not used for some fly-by-night school. And so then they're going to start putting criteria in as to what school you can use the voucher at. And before you know it, all the private schools are going to have to conform to the public standards, and it'll be just a leveling of schools. So this is what I'm worried about. And I think libertarians should be putting their creative hats on and thinking of some other way of freeing children from the government schools.
Yeah, I mean, just to elaborate on your points, and that was great. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing I was concerned about. I mean, this isn't like some tinfoil hat conspiracy paranoid nut job theory. I mean, clearly just the fact that they're vouchers for schools. I mean, you couldn't use these school vouchers to go get cigarettes at the gas station, you'd say, no, that's not what it's for. You couldn't, you know, if just some guy's brother-in-law sets up, you know, puts out a thing that says, hey, school's in session, and then has a bunch of kids come in watching TV and he's collecting tens of thousands of dollars a month in voucher checks. Clearly the authorities would come in and say, no, this doesn't count. And they'd shut it. They say, you're not eligible to get these checks. So clearly they would have to have some standards in place. And so, you know, isn't it incredibly naive to think that instead of it making the government schools as good as the private schools right now, wouldn't it just be the other way around?
Exactly. All the private schools will have to conform to the government standards very, very strictly. You know, and it's happened in the United States already. You know how it happened? The whole business of the government paying for college education got started with the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And there was corruption with the GI Bill. There were fly-by-night schools that got started. And so what did the government do? It started the whole accreditation process for colleges and universities. That's where it comes from. There was no accreditation process before that. You figured out what college you wanted to go to, and you looked into it, and you decided whether it was worth it or not. And of course, college was a lot cheaper then too. So the accreditation process now is a mess, because it's a very insular system where the same people who are teaching are the ones that are the ones that are accrediting other places. And as some of your listeners may know, the left has pretty much taken over the professoriate in the colleges and the universities. So what happens then? You know, who gets accredited and who doesn't?
Right. And I also saw you mention in the article that it's not merely formally, you know, state universities, but even private schools by virtue of the fact, you know, if the students are getting subsidized Stafford loans or whatever, and famously Hillsdale College, you know, I guess was in the 70s, they had that standoff where, mm-hmm. you know, it was something about reporting like the characteristics of their student body to the government or something. And they said, no, it's our institution. We don't have to give you that information. We're private. And then the feds, you know, they ruled and said, no, if you have one student going to your school who takes one penny of federal aid, then you have to do everything we say. And so then, you know, Hillsdale famously came up with a, you know, fundraising effort to replace the funding so their students didn't have to leave. And I think Grove City College also now, you know, mm-hmm. is in the same position. But just showing how insidious it is that when you have, you know, government, quote, helping students, it gets its tentacles and everything. And then it can plausibly argue. Or it's even like with the states. My understanding is the way when they wanted to make the national speed limit 55 miles an hour, it's not that they had a constitutional battle. It's just they said, okay, well, we'll withhold your highway funding. You know, we have the money. We can choose to not give you money. So you set your speed limit like what we say. You know,
that's
that kind
exactly
of thing.
What they did. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and the thing is, this thing about vouchers, it's already happening because I saw an article about some school in Baltimore that was using vouchers, mm-hmm. but they were a Christian school. And so they didn't want to follow whatever LGBTQ guidelines that the government wanted. And so the government was going to withdraw the vouchers from that school, wasn't going to allow vouchers to be used at that school. Now, you know, whatever you think about LGBT guidelines, it's really in a free market, the school should have the right to decide what guidelines they're going to follow and what they're not, mm-hmm. you know, but they were going to take away the vouchers.
And I'm glad you brought it's amazing to me. It's so obvious but I never thought of it, like the analogy with the higher education, because clearly even people who are for school vouchers at the lower level can agree something got really screwed up at higher education levels. And they can see, you know, the fact that it's a private university versus a public one is not, you know, that huge of a distinction at this point. And I think part of the mechanism would be that some of the analysis to, you know, to say, oh, well, the school, you know, private schools can just, you know, they're not being hurt by not having or by having the option of accepting the money. And like you're saying, clearly there'd be like an arms race and that wouldn't happen. But even beyond that, I think people would be much less vigilant in keeping property taxes down if now they could rationalize, oh, well, actually, a lot of my money is coming back in the form of the voucher. So I think property taxes would end up being higher. So it's actually not that you'd be better off and now have more options about what to do with, quote, your tax dollars. I think they would end up siphoning more away from you and then dribbling it back. So it's everybody would be worse off.
I didn't think of that, but I think you're probably absolutely right. And certainly in my state of Illinois, mm-hmm. they will do anything to figure out how to get more taxes from us.
So it would be the mirror image of saying, oh, well, you know, if the government's giving aid to students and unsubsidized Stafford loan and Pell Grants and whatever, and GI Bill, they can just refrain from taking it. Well, no, not if tuition gets driven up because of those programs. Now you, quote, need the student aid from the government just to be able to afford the tuition. Whereas if they hadn't gotten involved in the first place, the tuition would have been much more affordable.
Yeah, so, I mean, your audience understands that it was government loans that caused the inflation of tuition in colleges and universities way beyond regular inflation. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to Northwestern in the 70s, and in the 70s, we were paying a really expensive $3,000 a year. And I looked at what Northwestern's tuition should be just by inflation. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, it should be about $16,000. I think it's $48,000 today.
Yeah, it's shocking.
It's partly able to charge that because it's considered an elite school now, but still, it's way beyond inflation, and it's happened at all the schools all over the country because the government loans encouraged people to spend money. Since when the kids go to school, they don't have to pay anything back while they're in school. And when they do pay things back, it was very small amounts at first. It was like free money. I mean, people didn't understand the personal finance side of it at all. And they took more and more loans on. They were told, oh, you have to have a college degree to get a good job. And we've just had this tremendous, with the demand went way up and the schools basically, I consider it welfare for colleges, all these student loans. So it's a disaster what's happened.
Right. And it's, and the thing is, I don't know if it'd be better, but it would be one thing if it were literally just they were paying, partially covering your tuition. But no, the kids still come out owing somebody, $100,000 plus in debt, depending on how much it was. So it's a perverse thing where it drives up the costs and the government's, guaranteeing the loans and certain creditors get sweetheart deals and whatnot. And the kids can't bankrupt out of it and things like that. And yet they're still indebted. So it's not even, it'd be like if you took food stamps, but then had to pay them back or something. Like it'd be welfare plus debt.
Right. You know that there are at least 10 people who owe $1 million each.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a little mind-boggling.
And they're not because they became excellent brain surgeons and they're going to knock that out over the course of 6 years.
It might have, yeah. I mean, well, a brain surgeon, he takes so long to, he's like 35 or 40 by the time he can actually practice. So, who knows if he could ever make it back. I don't know. But I was reading an article about a dentist who had racked up that much. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how you rack up that much, but he did.
Wow. Well, people can say, I'm sure, all right, well, you don't like we all recognize the current system's messed up, and you're saying this popular recommendation of school vouchers is not the silver bullet that a lot of libertarian types think. So, what is your solution or what's your vision of a free market in education?
Well, I mean, the thing to me that sounds like it might be less intrusive is tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
Because there it's your, it's still your money that you're, if the listeners don't understand it. So what you would be able to do with tax credits is whatever you're spending in education, you could deduct it from straight off of your taxes. So it wouldn't be a deduction, but it would actually be a credit off of your taxes.
Right. So your tax liability gets reduced dollar for dollar by the the qualified educational expense.
And of course, if you allowed anybody who wanted to pay for somebody's education to do that, then you could fund all kinds of kids that would need scholarships, Mm-hmm. So say there was a wealthy, retired couple, and they knew they belonged to some organization that tried to help disadvantaged children. They could give scholarship money to those children and they could take it as a credit on their tax return. I mean, you could get tremendous amounts of money that way for children because one of the immediate objections is, well, what about the children whose parents don't make enough tax to actually cover the tuition, to make a big difference?
Right.
Well, this is how you could fund that kind of thing. And, the United States is one of the most generous nations in the world when it comes to charity and when it comes to paying for education. We value it so much.
Just for the benefit of people who might be confused, the distinction between the standard voucher program and what you're talking about, tax credits, is a standard voucher program that, like, they might say, oh, okay, if your kid went to the public school down the street, we would be spending on your behalf the equivalent of $4,000 a year. I'm making these numbers up, obviously. So if instead you want to go to a private school, we'll give you a check and you can go. So it's like we're spending the tax dollars that had been earmarked for you at this other institution.
No, you would pay directly that institution and then you would take it off your taxes.
No, I'm saying that's what a voucher program is, what I just said.
Oh, whereas, yes, I'm sorry. Yes,
whereas yours is, that a family that was, pretty poor, like they wouldn't have the tax liability. So yeah, if they sent their kid to a school that costs $4,000 a year, they would have the ability to take $4,000 right off their tax liability. But if they didn't owe that much in the first place, then that would be, but you're saying some philanthropic organization, they, raised a charitable donation and paid the kid's tuition. Maybe the kid does well on an exam or writes a good essay or something and wins the award. And so he gets the funding. Then that organization could at least say, hey, so we get the tax credit.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't know if that's a safe enough way to do it, because could it go to the courts and say, oh, well, it's really, government money, and so the government should be able to oversee how the money is spent. That could happen too with a tax credit. I'm just not sure, I'm just saying that's as close as I can think of. how to handle it. But I'm just giving it out there as a challenge to people in the libertarian community to come up with some alternative. You know, is there a more brilliant or creative alternative than that?
Right. Well, I'm just brainstorming here. I mean, I think maybe I'll say something dumb and then have your listeners will point out in the comment. But I think at least that has one layer more of protection than the voucher approach, because it seems different. If under the voucher program, they're quite literally spending tax dollars to send this kid over to the private school. And so if it ends up, you know, having low standards or looks pretty corrupt, I could see the public getting outraged. Whereas if you're just doing it to lower your tax bill, it's not that you're pocketing the money. It's just you're lowering your tax. And also there is a sense in which it's not the rest of the taxpayers are themselves giving money to you. It's that the amount you otherwise would have had to chip into the common pot is reduced. You're keeping more of your money as opposed to taking everybody else's tax dollars to devote to this project. So I could see how, you know, the government oversight might not be as severe, at least in that kind of application.
Right, right. But I'm saying I'm still worried about it because of what could be ruled in the courts, you know. And so that's why I'm saying I'd like to throw out a challenge to libertarian thinkers to come up with some other alternative.
Sure, sure.
There's some other way to break down, you know, to put a wedge in the system to start changing things, you know, open up the market. I don't know.
Well, putting aside for the moment the question of, you know, how do we get there? I know you have some thoughts on what a genuinely free market education would look like. Do you want to share some of those views?
Oh, sure. Well, I think if you had a real free market in education, in other words, no government involvement. Now, the reason we end up having public schooling is because people were worried that the hordes of immigrants that were coming into the United States at the beginning of the 19th century weren't going to learn enough about how to behave and the values and virtues and ideas of actually the Protestants that lived here at the time. But they did have a concern: would they learn the the civics, for example, that you need to understand to be a free person in a free society? But if we had a completely free market in education, so that's one of the reasons why public education was started. They said, oh, there's all these poor children, these immigrant children, they can't pay for school, so we're going to set up a public program.
And weren't a lot of them worried about the Catholic schools? Like a lot of the Protestants were worried, and so they were going to neutralize the Catholic menace kind of thing? Yeah.
Yes, yes. That was a big problem. The Irish were a real big problem.
And so, of course, the lesson there being it came back to bite them that, oh, yeah, you run to the government to protect your religion, and then look what happens. Now that you can't pray in school and that kind of stuff. Can't have the Ten Commandments up.
Well, the ironic thing is that one of the most famous people to start in the beginning of the public school system was Horace Mann. Many people probably know his name. He started the public school system in Boston in 1832. By 1837, he was complaining about it.
I didn't know it was that fast.
I read about this in Richard Hofstadter's book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, that was written in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And Hofstadter was a kind of old line, left liberal. But he gives he has quotes from Mann where Mann's saying, oh, yeah, the children, they're so disorderly and they can't read and they can't do this and they're not learning their numbers. This is 5 years after the Institute of the Public Schools.
That's funny, because I actually, just tying into some of the things we've mentioned here, I was an undergrad at Hillsdale College because I went there because I liked Austrian economics and they had Mises' personal library there. And I wrote a term paper for one of my econ classes on the origin of the public school. And I was talking about Horace Mann and stuff, and it got published as a fee article. So there's that.
Nice.
By the way, folks, so this is BobMurphyShow.com/59, where we'll put the links of all the stuff we're talking about. And if I can find that, I'll put it up there. But yeah, I don't think in my paper, I don't think I realized how quickly Horace Mann realized, oh, this isn't working out. That's funny.
Yes, I was astounded to read that. And then Hofstadter has quotes from all kinds of different people in the 19th century. You know, it said how wealthy parents wanted to support the public school systems, and so they would put their kids in them, and then they couldn't stand them, and they'd take them out. And this happened in the 19th century.
Sure.
So I wrote an article, a chapter for this book, Common Ground and Common Core, about what education would be like in a free society. Mm-hmm. And the beginning part of the article has a lot of the history of education in the United States in it. So there's quotes from, I don't know how many people know that The public school system was modeled after the Prussian system, which was first started under the encouragement of Martin Luther and the Calvinists, who wanted citizens to conform to the state and to be prepared to be in their armies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be like obedient workers and you know, serve in the military and yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of, I think people would be really surprised to find out how much conformity is basically built into and a philosophy behind public education.
Wait, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, because I think for a lot of people, they almost thought it was like, they thought it was a bug, but no, it's a feature. Like that was the point. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not that this just was, oh, wow, they were trying to, you know, foster kids who are really good at ballet and look what popped out. No, that's not at all what they were trying to do. So,
exactly. I mean, and people tend to think of public education as, oh, it's to help the poor kids who can't and get everybody to be, you know, good American citizens. But it's there's many different motives behind it than that. So. But anyway, getting back to what it would look like if it was a completely free market, I think we would have an incredible variety of schools for children of all different kinds, depending on what the parents thought were good for their children, whatever innovations people could come up with. You know, there might be schools, there'd be small schools, there'd be large schools, there'd be urban schools, there'd be suburban schools, there'd be country schools, schools on a farm, there'd be schools maybe in a factory, who knows? You know, it depends on what people came up with. And I think that people would understand more. They'd be much more oriented to, well, what does my child need to know in order to live as a free person? Because in a free society, you have to be self-responsible. You have to be productive. You have to know how to interact with other people. You have to be respectful of property. So they'd be thinking about that kind of thing. It'd be a much bigger issue in the culture, you know. And so the schools would reflect that. And I think that in like I said, in terms of the tax credits, I think that since people, especially in a free society, really value education and want their fellow citizens to be in good circumstances because they know that it rebounds back to them. Because if you have somebody next door who's really poor and struggling, they are going to be more motivated to take your stuff. Mm-hmm. Then, I mean, one of the reasons why we have, on the whole, a very peaceful society these days is because people are comfortable. They have their basic needs taken care of. They have their own stuff. They can produce their own work. And so that allows them to be comfortable in their own lives. They don't have to be worrying about where's their next mouthful coming from, you know, and they're much more likely to be respectful of your property. Well, I think this would happen in a thriving free society, and people would be concerned about the other people being educated so that they could be productive and they could be good citizens. And there would be a lot of scholarship money given out there for kids that whose parents couldn't pay for it. I think that would just be a natural consequence. And furthermore, you know, then you always have the question, well, what about the children whose parents really don't care, you know, they're really irresponsible people. How do we get those children educated, right? Well, that's where I think very creative people can come up with ways to incentivize those parents. You know, is there something those parents want that you can say, all right, if you send your child to school, then we'll give you this. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll like a lottery money. I don't know. You know, I'm saying this is where creative thinking has to come into play. But I think you'd have very, very few children who went without getting, who couldn't get an education in a free society.
Well, also too, and I mean, here I'm speaking, I guess, mostly anecdotally, but the idea that, oh, because there's going to be some parents out there who really don't care one way or the other, whether their kid's educated. And the solution to that is to have mandatory school attendance laws, truancy laws and whatever. And the police are going to drag kids to school and make them sit in there. I mean, it's not that those kids are coming out, you know, being Renaissance men and women. If your parents really don't care if you go to school or not, I mean, that's a huge strike again. You know, there's not much you can do for those kids. I mean, it's unfortunate. It's not the kids' fault, but it's the idea that we've solved that problem. Thank you very much by having school attendance laws is goofy.
Oh no, that's yeah no. And I mean, anybody who knows anything about what goes on in these inner city schools knows that the education is not going on. So just because they have to go to school is not making them be educated. So
sure. Now, I know, I guess in the remaining time we have here, you've got the, it's called the Great Connection. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This is a program I started for young adults, the 16 to 24 age of development. And I started it about 10 years ago in summer programs. My aim is to help young people become independent adults and help them develop the skills, the knowledge, and the experiences they need to be able to decide, understand anything for themselves and figure out what they should do with their lives. So I put together a program which has a methodology that really increases independent reasoning powers and judgment in anything that the person is trying to learn. And they end up coming out with tremendous self-confidence. And I've been running that as summer programs for the last 10 years here in Chicago. And now we're opening a gap year program. What I mean by that is a lot of kids now are questioning whether they should go on to college or what should they do or which college should they go to. And they're deciding to take a year off between high school and college. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes in the middle of college, they'll take a year off because they've gone to college for a couple of years. It's not really fulfilled what they thought it was going to fulfill. I mean, I've had many recent college graduates tell me how disappointed they were in going to college because they thought it was going to be something really different. You know, they were going to be challenged. They were going to learn a lot of new ideas. They were going to be treated as adults. And instead, they feel like it's just another high school experience where it's learn this stuff,
right,
and take a test.
Getting busy work and stuff. Yeah.
Right. Right. You know, so a lot of people are taking time off to figure out what they want to do. And it's called a gap year. So we've created a gap year program that incorporates intensive individual self-reflection, learning ideas that are really important to figuring out what to do with the rest of your life, learning principles of personal finance, of economics, of technology, the market, and having an experience in the middle of the year with actually trying to solve a real-world problem in a small group. And there's many different aspects to it. We have 10 weeks when it would be a collaborative, in our collaborative discussions. We use a very specialized form of what's called a Socratic seminar, mm-hmm. in which students, the teacher is the guide to the work, not the expert on the work. And the teacher is there to help students try to understand the work themselves. And what happens in these classes is that the students end up really developing their reasoning powers because of it. And so we've got a curriculum organized so that the students will be answering questions of, how do I know what's true? How do I live? How should I live with other people? And they'll be reading very great writers who have wrestled with this problem across the ideological spectrum. The idea being that, you know, if you're really going to be educated, you have to know ideas from all points of view, and then you make up your own mind about it. And so for 10 weeks, we're working on that. They'll also have a special course in writing. We have a teacher who was a advertising executive at J. Walter Thompson for 25 years, but he also was a student of Richard McKeon at the University of Chicago. And so he brings the skills of Aristotle's rhetoric, of professional advertising writing, and the kinds of things that Shakespeare was schooled in, the kind of rhetoric and methodologies that Shakespeare was schooled in, to teach the students how to write to get something done. Because most writing that you do in school is just expositional writing where you're explaining something.
Right.
And that's because the teacher wants to know, did you understand the material? But there's lots of different kinds of writing to do in life. You know, there's screenwriting, there's persuasion, there's expressing gratitude, as well as exposition. And so he has a method of teaching that.
Yeah, I know Tom Woods, my friend, has a course that he put, it's not his course, but he subscribed some guy like teaching how to write effective email messaging, mm-hmm. you know, to people who've subscribed to your email list. And that's a whole art in and of itself.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, and so this is based on the way that professional writers get things done, whether it's the screenwriters for Breaking Bad or it's Joan Rivers or it's a general or it's a novelist or it's an advertising executive. How do they actually get their writing done? And this is a tremendous skill to learn for when you go into work, because almost every intellectually oriented job, or a job that is a thinking job, a knowledge job, requires some kind of writing.
Right. And I mean, and people, you know, people have always been saying it, but I mean, it's not just a cliche. It really is true that no matter what your specific thing is, if you, you know, can be able to get up and give a presentation and be able to write persuasively, that's especially now with the ubiquity of people being online and so forth. And I can see that in a lot of professions, it's more important than ever to be able to express yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And and all along, the students will have a lot of individual attention. So once a week, for example, they'll be meeting with the tutors, the teachers, to go over, well, how do they feel they're progressing? Are they achieving their goals? You know, what maybe should they be looking at that would help them? Who should we put them in contact with? One of the things we want to do when in the second 10 weeks of the year, when they'll be working on a small group project on a real world problem, we whatever area it is, whether it's science, whether it's business, whether it's the arts, we want to put them in touch with very accomplished professionals in the field to help them mentor them in that area. And we have contacts all over the place for that purpose. And then the last 10 weeks of the year, they would come back and they would develop a portfolio of writing also the whole year and do a presentation or an implementation of the real world problem solution. And this portfolio would be useful for whatever they decide to do next, whether it's start a business, go to college, go into the crafts, arts, whether they want to go into the trades, you know, whatever they decide is the best thing for them to do. And then the last 10 weeks of the year, we'll be focusing on things like personal finance, economics, technology, the market, and also the role of art in a well-lived life. Because, you know, one of our aims is to help them develop into independent human beings who are going to live a good life. And so we want to help them be productive, but we also want to help them know how to enjoy their life. And art is a very important aspect of that.
Okay, great. And so the name of that, the overarching thing, is The Great Connections?
The Great Connections Leap Year.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. So I think we're probably at a logical stopping point here. So for people who want to learn more, if you're publishing or just to find you online, obviously we'll have links here, folks, at bobmurphyshow.com/59. But beyond that, Marcia, is there someplace you want them to look to find more about you?
Sure. Well, they can look at our website, thegreatconnections.org. And also, I have my own Facebook page, Marcia Enright. I have a website of all my writing, marcia-famolaro-enright.com. And so they can contact me through that. If they want to contact me directly, I'm at M, like Mary, Enright, Enright, at thegreatconnections.org.
Okay, well, great. So, Marcia Enright, thanks so much for being with us here on The Bob Murphy Show, and good luck with all your projects.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it, and thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Sure thing.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.